Part 2 of Chapter 10 of John Brown by W. E. Burghardt Du Bois. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The month of May, John Brown spent in Boston collecting funds and in New York consulting his Negro friends, with a trip to Connecticut to hurry the making of his 1,000 pikes. Sickness intervened, but at last on June 20th, the advance guard of 5, Brown and 2 of his sons, Jerry Anderson and Kagi, started southward. They stayed several days at Chambersburg, where Kagi, cooperating with a faithful Negro barber, Watson, was established as general agent to forward men, mail, and freight. Then passing through Hagerstown, they arrived at Harper's Ferry on July 4th. Here they met Cook, who had been selling maps, keeping the canal lock near the arsenal, and sending regular information to Brown. Brown and his sons wandered about at first, and a local farmer greeted them cheerily. "Good morning, gentlemen. How do you do?" They returned the greeting pleasantly. The conversation is recounted as follows. "I said, well, gentlemen," after saluting them in that form, "I suppose you are out hunting minerals, gold, and silver?" His answer was, "No, we are not. We are out looking for land. We want to buy land. We have a little money, but we want to make it go as far as we can." He asked me the price of the land. I told him that it ranged from $15 to $30 in the neighborhood. He remarked, "That is high. I thought I could buy land here for about $1 or $2 per acre." I remarked to him, "No, sir, if you expect to get land for that price, you will have to go further west, to Kansas or some of those territories where there is government land." I then asked him where they came from. His answer was, "From the northern part of the state of New York." I asked him what he followed there. He said farming, and the frost had been so heavy lately that it cut off their crops there, that he could not make anything, and sold out, and thought he would come further south and try it a while. Through this easy-going, inquisitive farmer, Brown learned of a farm for rent, which he hired for 9 months for $35. It was on the main road between Harper's Ferry, Chambersburg, and the north, about 5 miles from the ferry, and in a quiet, secluded place. The house stood about 300 yards back from the Boonesboro Pike, in plain sight. About 600 yards away, on the other side of the road, was another cabin of one room and a garret, which was largely hidden from view by the shrubbery. Here Brown settled, and gradually collected his men and material. The arms were especially slow in coming. Most of the guns arrived at Chambersburg from Connecticut about August, but the pikes did not come until a month later. Then, too, the men were gathered slowly. They were at the four ends of the country, in all sorts of employment and in different financial conditions, and they were not certain just when the raid would take place. All this delayed Brown from July until October, and greatly increased the cost of maintenance. A daughter, Anne, and Oliver's girl wife, came and kept house from July 16th to October 1st. At this critical juncture, Harriet Tubman fell sick, a grave loss to the cause, and there were other delays. By August 1st, there were at Harper's Ferry the 2 Brown daughters and 3 sons, and the 2 brothers of a son-in-law, besides the 2 Coppocks, Tidd, Jerry Anderson, and Stevens. Hazlett, Lehman, and Taylor came soon after. Kagi was still at Chambersburg, and John Brown himself labored and traveled night and day, sometimes on old Dolly, his brown mule, and sometimes in the wagon. He would start directly after night and travel the 50 miles between the farm and Chambersburg by daylight next morning, and he otherwise kept open communication between headquarters and the latter place, in order that matters might be arranged in due season. In the North, John Brown Jr. was shipping the arms and gathering men and money. He was in Boston August 10th, at Douglas's home soon after, and later in Canada with Logan. All the chief branches of the League were visited, and then Northern Ohio. The result was meager, not because of lack of men, but lack of the kind of men wanted at this time. There were thousands of Negroes ready to fight for liberty in the ranks, but most of these John Brown could not use at present. No considerable band of armed black men could have been introduced into the South without immediate discovery and civil war. It was therefore picked leaders like Douglas, Reynolds, Holden, and Delaney that Brown wanted at first, discreet and careful men of influence, who, as he said to Douglas, could hive the swarming bees both north and south. To get these picked men interested was, however, difficult. Each had his work and his theory of racial salvation. They were widely scattered. A number of them had been convinced in 1858, but the postponement had given time for reflection and doubt. In many ways, the original enthusiasm had waned, but it was not dead. The cause was just as great, and all that was needed was to convince men that this was a real chance to strike an effective blow. They required the magic of Brown's own presence to impress this fact upon them. They were not sure of his agents. Men continued to come, however. Others began to prepare, and still others were almost persuaded. An urgent summons went to Kansas to white fellow workers, and the response there was similarly small. Brown knew that his ability to command the services of a large number of Northern Negroes depended, in some degree, on Frederick Douglass's attitude. He was the first great national Negro leader, a man of ability, finesse, and courage. If he followed John Brown, who could hesitate? If he refused, was it not for the best of reasons? Thus John Brown continually urged Douglas, and, as a last appeal, arranged for a final conference on August 19th at Chambersburg in an abandoned stone quarry. Douglas says, "As I came near, he regarded me rather suspiciously, but soon recognized me and received me cordially. He had in his hand when I met him a fishing tackle, with which he had apparently been fishing in a stream hard by, but I saw no fish, and did not suppose he cared much for his fisherman's luck. The fishing was simply a disguise, and was certainly a good one. He looked every way like a man of the neighborhood, and as much at home as any of the farmers around there. His hat was old and storm-beaten, and his clothing was about the color of the stone quarry itself, his then present dwelling place. His face wore an anxious expression, and he was much worn by thought and exposure. I felt that I was on a dangerous mission, and was as little desirous of discovery as himself, though no reward had been offered for me. We, Mr. Kagi, Captain Brown, Shields Green, and myself, sat down among the rocks and talked over the enterprise which was about to be undertaken. The taking of Harper's Ferry, of which Captain Brown had merely hinted before, was now declared as his settled purpose, and he wanted to know what I thought of it. I at once opposed the measure with all the arguments at my command. To me, such a measure would be fatal to running off slaves, as was the original plan, and fatal to all engaged in doing so. It would be an attack upon the federal government, and would array the whole country against us. Captain Brown did most of the talking on the other side of the question. He did not at all object to rousing the nation. It seemed to him that something startling was just what the nation needed. Our talk was long and earnest. We spent the most of Saturday and a part of Sunday in this debate, Brown for Harper's Ferry and I against it, he for striking a blow which should instantly rouse the country, and I for the policy of gradually and unaccountably drawing off the slaves to the mountains, as at first suggested and proposed by him. When I found that he had fully made up his mind and could not be dissuaded, I turned to Shields Green and told him he heard what Captain Brown had said, his old plan was changed, and that I should return home, and if he wished to go with me, he could do so. Captain Brown urged us both to go with him, but I could not do so, and could but feel that he was about to rivet the fetters more firmly than ever on the limbs of the enslaved. In parting, he put his arms around me in a manner more than friendly, and said, "Come with me, Douglas. I will defend you with my life. I want you for a special purpose. When I strike, the bees will begin to swarm, and I shall want you to help hive them." But my discretion, or my cowardice, made me proof against the dear old man's eloquence. Perhaps it was something of both which determined my course. When about to leave, I asked Green what he had decided to do, and was surprised by his coolly saying, in his broken way, "I believe I'll go with the old man." Here we separated, they to go to Harper's Ferry, I to Rochester. Douglas's decision undoubtedly kept many Negroes from joining Brown. Shields Green, however, started south. The slave catchers followed him and made him and Owen Brown swim a river. Only their journeying southward instead of northward saved them from capture. The life at the farm during this time was curious. Anderson says, "There was no milk and water sentimentality, no offensive contempt for the Negro while working in his cause. The pulsations of each and every heart beat in harmony for the suffering and pleading slave. I thank God that I have been permitted to realize to its furthest, fullest extent the moral, mental, physical, social harmony of an anti-slavery family, carrying out to the letter the principles of its antitype, the anti-slavery cause. In John Brown's house, and in John Brown's presence, men from widely different parts of the continent met and united into one company, wherein no hateful prejudice dared intrude its ugly self, no ghost of distinction found space to enter. To a passer-by, the house and its surroundings presented but indifferent attractions. Any log tenement of equal dimensions would be as likely to arrest a stray glance. Rough, unsightly, and aged, it was only for those privileged to enter and tarry for a long time, and to penetrate the mysteries of the two rooms it contained, kitchen, parlor, dining room below, and the spacious chamber, attic, storeroom, prison, drilling room comprised in the loft above, who could tell how we lived at Kennedy Farm. Every morning, when the noble old man was at home, he called the family around, read from his Bible, and offered to God most fervent and touching supplications for all flesh, and especially pathetic were his petitions in behalf of the oppressed. I never heard John Brown pray that he did not make strong appeals to God for the deliverance of the slave. This duty over, the men went to the loft, there to remain all day long. Few only could be seen about, as the neighbors were watchful and suspicious. It was also important to talk but little among ourselves, as visitors to the house might be curious. Besides the daughter and daughter-in-law, who superintended the work, someone or other of the men was regularly detailed to assist in the cooking, washing, and other domestic work. After the ladies left, we did all the work, no one being exempt because of age or official grade in the organization. The principal employment of the prisoners, as we severally were when compelled to stay in the loft, was to study Forbes's manual and to go through a quiet, though rigid, drill under the training of Captain Stevens at some times. At other times, we applied a preparation for bronzing our gun barrels, discussed subjects of reform, related our personal history. But when our resources became pretty well exhausted, the ennui from confinement, imposed silence, etc., would make the men almost desperate. At such times, neither slavery nor slaveholders were discussed mincingly. We were, while the ladies remained, often relieved of much of the dullness growing out of restraint by their kindness. As we could not circulate freely, they would bring in wild fruit and flowers from the woods and fields. Anne, the young daughter, says, "One day, a short time after I went down there, Father was sitting at the table writing. I was nearby sewing, he and I being alone in the room, when two little wrens that had a nest under the porch came flying in at the door, fluttering and twisting. Then they flew back to their nest, and again to us, several times, seemingly trying to attract our attention. They appeared to be in great distress. I asked Father what he thought was the matter with the little birds. He asked if I had ever seen them act so before. I told him no. "Then let us go and see," he said. We went out and found that a snake had crawled up the post and was just ready to devour the little ones in the nest. Father killed the snake, and then the old birds sat on the railing and sang as if they would burst. It seemed as if they were trying to express their joy and gratitude to him for saving their little ones. After we went back into the room, he said he thought it very strange the way the birds asked him to help them, and asked if I thought it an omen of his success. He seemed very much impressed with that idea. I do not think he was superstitious, but you know he always thought and felt that God called him to that work, and seemed to place himself, or rather to imagine himself, in the position of the figure in the old seal of Virginia, with the tyrant under her foot. The men discussed religion and slavery freely, read Paine's Age of Reason and the Baltimore Sun. John Brown himself was careful to cultivate the goodwill of his neighbors, attending with skill the sick among animals and men, so much so that he and his sons became prime favorites. Owen had long conversations with the people, while Cook was also moving about the country selling maps. A little Dunker chapel was near with non-resistant anti-slavery principles. Here, John Brown often worshipped and preached. Yet with all this caution and care, suspicion lurked about them, and discovery was always imminent. Brown's daughter relates that there was a family of poor people who lived nearby, and who had rented the garden on the Kennedy place directly back of the house. The little barefooted woman and four small children, she carried the youngest in her arms, would all come trooping over to the garden at all hours of the day, and at times several times during the day. Nearly always they would come up the steps and into the house and stay a short time. This made it very troublesome for us, compelling the men, when she came in sight at meal times, to gather up the victuals and tablecloth and quietly disappear upstairs. One Saturday, Father and I went to a religious Dunker meeting that was held in a grove near the schoolhouse, and the folks left at home forgot to keep a sharp lookout for Mrs. Heithmaster, and she stole into the house before they saw her, and saw Shields Green, that must have been in September, Barclay Coppock, and Will Lehman. And another time after that, she saw C.P. Tidd standing on the porch. She thought these strangers were running off Negroes to the north. I used to give her everything she wanted or asked for to keep her on good terms, but we were in constant fear that she was either a spy or would betray us. It was like standing on a powder magazine after a slow match had been lighted. Despite all precautions, rumor began to get in the air. A Prussian Pole was among the Kansas cooperators invited. He had been in Kansas in 1856 and was known to Brown and Kagi. After hearing from Brown in August 1859, the Pole disclosed their plans to Edmund Babb, a correspondent of the Cincinnati Gazette. It was probably Babb who thereupon wrote to the United States Secretary of War, "I have discovered the existence of a secret association, having for its object the liberation of the slaves at the South, and by a general insurrection. The leader of the movement is old John Brown, late of Kansas." Approximately correct details of the plot followed, but Secretary Floyd was lolling at a summer resort, and had some little conspiracies of his own in hand, not unconnected with United States arsenals. "Being, therefore, as he said magniloquently, satisfied in my own mind that a scheme of such wickedness and outrage could not be entertained by any citizens of the United States, I put the letter away, and thought no more of it until the raid broke out." Gerrit Smith, too, with little discretion, addressed to a Negro audience words which plainly showed he shortly expected a slave insurrection. Even among the Harper's Ferry party, forced inaction led to dispute and disaffection. John Brown sharply rebuked the letter-writing and gossiping of his own men. "Any person is a stupid fool," he told Kagi, "who expects his friends to keep for him that which he cannot keep himself. All our friends have each got their special friends, and they again have theirs, and it would not be right to lay the burden of keeping a secret on anyone at the end of a long string. I could tell you of reasons I have for feeling rather keenly on this point." The men, on the other hand, were dissatisfied with Brown's plans as they were finally disclosed. Anne Brown writes that they generally did not know that the raid on the government works was a part of the plan until after they arrived at the farm in the beginning of August. They wanted simply to repeat the Missouri raid on a larger scale and not try to capture the arsenal. Tidd was especially stubborn and irreconcilable. The discussion became so warm that John Brown at one time resigned, but he was immediately re-elected, and this formal letter was sent him. "Dear Sir, we have all agreed to sustain your decisions until you have proved incompetent, and many of us will adhere to your decisions so long as you will." In these ways, Brown was compelled to hurry, and accordingly he urged his eldest son, who replied, "Through those associations which I formed in Canada, I am able to reach each individual member at the shortest notice by letter. I am devoting my whole time to our company business, shall immediately go out organizing and raising funds. From what I even had understood, I had supposed you would not think it best to commence opening the coal banks before spring, unless circumstances should make it imperative. However, I suppose the reasons are satisfactory to you, and if so, those who own smaller shares ought not to object. I hope we shall be able to get on in season some of those old miners of whom I wrote you, shall strain every nerve to accomplish this. You may be assured that what you say to me will reach those who may be benefited thereby, and those who would take stock, in the shortest possible time, so don't fail to keep me posted." As late as October 6th, Brown expected to move about the end of the month, and made a hurried trip to Philadelphia. There he met a large group of Negroes, and Dorsey, the caterer with whom he stayed at 1221 Locust Street, is said to have given him $300. In some way, he was disappointed with the visit. Anderson says he went on business of great importance. How important, men there and elsewhere now know. How affected by and affecting the main features of the enterprise, we at the farm knew full after their return, as the old captain, in the fullness of his overflowing, saddened heart, detailed point after point of interest. Perhaps he was still trying to persuade Douglas, and the leaders of the Philadelphia and New York groups. The women left the farm late in September, and O.P. Anderson, Copeland, and Leary arrived. Merriam joined Brown while he was on the Philadelphia trip, and was sent to Baltimore to buy caps for the guns. Others were coming when suddenly Brown fixed on October 17th as the date of the raid. This hurried change was probably because officials and neighbors were getting inquisitive, and arms were being removed from the arsenal to man southern stations. Yet it was unfortunate, as Anderson says. Could other parties, waiting for the word, have reached the headquarters in time for the outbreak when it took place, the taking of the armory, engine house, and rifle factory would have been quite different. But the men at the farm had been so closely confined that they went out about the house and farm in the daytime during that week, and so indiscreetly exposed their numbers to the prying neighbors, who thereupon took steps to have a search instituted in the early part of the coming week. Captain Brown was not seconded in another quarter as he expected at the time of the action, but could the fears of the neighbors have been allayed for a few days, the disappointment in the former respect would not have been of much weight. Only the nearest of the slaves roundabout who awaited the word could be communicated with, and several recruits like Hinton were left stranded on the way, unable to get through in time. So the great day dawned. On Sunday morning, October 16th, Captain Brown arose earlier than usual and called his men down to worship. He read a chapter from the Bible, applicable to the condition of the slaves and our duty as their brethren, and then offered up a fervent prayer to God to assist in the liberation of the bondmen in that slaveholding land. The services were impressive. A council was held, over which O.P. Anderson, the colored man, presided. In the afternoon, the final orders were given, and at night, just before setting out, John Brown said, "And now, gentlemen, let me impress this one thing upon your minds. You all know how dear life is to you, and how dear life is to your friends. And in remembering that, consider that the lives of others are as dear to them as yours are to you. Do not, therefore, take the life of anyone if you can possibly avoid it, but if it is necessary to take life in order to save your own, then make sure work of it." End of chapter 10.